Welcome back to Arts About.
Show about art, Sally. That's a work of art regardless of whether a Monsieur Stewart is here or not.
Very good. I just don't know how you even managed to do that, to change it round each week. No, we don't have Mark Stewart in with us today.
He's in the arms of his lover in an apartment in Melbourne somewhere.
Oh, lucky Mark. Arts About is, of course, brought to you by the generosity of the McClellan Sculpture Park and Gallery and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. You're listening to me, Sally Bailiw, and artist-in-residence and cultural sounding board, John Baird. And as you say, John, Mark's not here.
No.
But we do have Brody keeping us on air and on time as usual. What are you going to talk about today?
Greece.
Greece? Yeah. Greece the musical or Greece the country?
I was going to talk about Greece, the stuff that you use to make your car move.
Oh.
But as I thought about it and I thought, no, we'll talk about Greece the country.
Oh, okay then. Yeah. Good. All right. Well, I'll look forward to that. We're also going to be talking to Megan Greenwood, who's a local jeweller from Macrae, whose work has struck the eye of friend of the show, Virginia Dowser, curator of the Melbourne Spring Fashion Festival exhibition that's on in the Town Hall during Fashion Week. She's visiting us today to talk about her work and that fabulous exhibition, Marrying Artists, whose work intersects with fashion. We're also going to be talking with Jock Sarong, lawyer turned writer turned successful author, who's going to be in conversation with me at the next literary lunch on at Cakes and Ale and sponsored by Antipodes Bookshop in Sorrento, Friday, August the 25th. And we're going to find out what it's like to be an artist in residence at the Police Point in Portsea, John.
I'm always tempted to laugh at Jock Sarong's name, but it's so impressive.
It's a great name.
It is a great name.
Yeah, it's a great name, and he is a great writer. Mm. So it's kind of going to be exciting to talk to him. And we'll hear a little bit more about Siobhan Kelly, who's in situ at Police Point at the moment. First up, jeweller, silversmith, Megan Greenwood. So while we get her into her spot at the mic, here's a little bit of Dan Kelly and Martha Wainwright with their version of the song that Brian Ferry wrote, Slave to Love, recorded on Rockwiz. As I mentioned earlier, Megan Greenwood is a local silversmith who creates wearable art from her studio in Macrae. She's also an example of how living and carving out an artistic career on the Mornington Peninsula, if you're good at what you do, is becoming increasingly possible due to social technologies. Megan's creating a name for herself in wider circles, and earlier this year she was asked to participate in a runway event with Raw Melbourne, an organisation who showcased Melbourne's best emerging creatives. And now she's being included in the Melbourne Spring Fashion Week exhibition curated by Uber stylist and champion of the visual communications, Virginia Dowser. She's with us here today to tell us what she's up to and how to find her work, and to remind us all that there are some fascinating young artists living and creating here on the Mornington Peninsula. Hi, Megan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for coming into Arts About. Megan, first tell us a little bit about your work. I've seen a lot of marine creatures. I had a look on Etsy and Instagram and saw quite a few of them. What's the inspiration? Why, you know, are you fascinated by the world of underwater?
Yeah, I think when I started creating, I was sort of trying to find what resonates with me, and I'm a water baby, so everything sort of, I was naturally drawn to the sea, and I can express myself through those things.
Did you grow up on the Mornington Peninsula?
No, I grew up in the country out near Wagga.
Oh, which might be why you're obsessed by the sea now.
Yes, exactly.
Did you love The Little Mermaid when you were
young? Yes, of course I did.
Yeah. Well, we've looked at some of your beautiful rings, and it looks to me as if you mostly work in silver.
Yes,
yeah. And there's some pearls in amongst it as well.
Yeah, I'm sort of branching out this year into more gold, and I'm also designing my wedding collection. So that's going to be sort of, it's going to trickle into something new, which is exciting. And
Now, I mentioned just before that I saw your work originally on Instagram and Etsy, and you mentioned just a second ago that you've also just launched a new website.
Yes.
Are these the marketing tools really that young artists like yourself go to now?
Yeah, I think for me and also for my friends, Instagram's probably the biggest one. Mm-hmm. I haven't needed to put things into the search engine, which I'm sure I should. Instagram, I get everything off Instagram, basically. All my clients come to me through that. And
do they?
Instagram stories and, yeah.
So there's no kind of need, really, for you to put your work into a terrestrial, like a shop, is there?
Maybe. I mean, it's something that I should branch into, but at the moment this has been working really well for me. And I communicate a lot with my Instagram followers, and I actually I love my clients and I love talking to them and building those relationships. So I think a business can thrive on purely social media if you're engaging with your clients.
Okay. Now, are you trained as a silversmith?
I am. I did 2 years at Box Hill Institute.
Yeah.
And got all my basic training, and there's a lot that I'm still learning. And I also was taught by another local artist, Justin Bohme. He's one of the best, you know, Melbourne silversmiths. He's really very good at what he does. So I'm lucky to have been taught sort of by these different people, yeah.
And now you have set up your own studio in Macrae.
Actually, it's in Hastings. So it's my goodness, Marine Parade. I was living in Macrae.
Oh, were you?
Yes, okay. Yes. So I do love it there. I might move there one day, but I'm on Marine Parade, and I'm with Lisa Warrington and Julie Niekamp.
Oh, okay.
Other beautiful artists, and we'll be doing a lot of collaborations, and we're all going to be teaching as well. So. Oh, that's really exciting.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, that word collaborations is something that I know that really gets Virginia Dowser, the stylist who's curating this exhibition that's part of Melbourne Fashion Festival, that gets her juices going.
Yeah.
This particular exhibition that's coming up that you're going to participate in, I think it's in September, isn't it, Melbourne Spring Fashion Week?
Start of, yeah.
What are you going to be working at the exhibition, or are you just putting some work into the exhibition?
Yeah, I'll just be putting in a piece. So I'm actually working on my piece at the moment, and that's going to be put into a cube. And the way Virginia's sort of making it sounds like it's all more of like a storytelling event, like you're going to go and you're going to be very impressed by the different people. Daily it will change so that, you know, people can keep coming back and seeing new things.
Oh, it's a changing exhibition.
I hope I'm allowed to say that.
Oh,
yes.
You heard it here first, folks. Well, no doubt at some point we'll get Virginia in again to talk about it. Tell me, I mean, just recently I mentioned a little bit earlier too that you were part of the Raw Melbourne group.
Yes.
Part of a catwalk show.
Yeah, so that was my first exhibition runway show out of uni. So that was actually in 2014. It was my launch into what I do. I made the music with my cousin Matthew Buchan for the runway. I basically was offered to do that and to curate it, and not just to have a stall to sell my jewelry, but to put together. So I curated the dance, chose my models. I basically got obsessive, as I do when I'm working, and wanted to control the whole thing and make it this magical experience. So it was really good for like a first step into my business, and it sort of helped, I guess, guide what I'm doing now. I guess that's sort of, yeah.
How did they find you?
Oh, I actually, it might have been something on the internet that they, from memory, yeah. It was someone saw something via Facebook, and one of the ladies who was organizing,
actually saw it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is really how these mechanisms work, isn't it? So,
social
presumably,
media.
So where was this catwalk show?
Oh, it was in the city, somewhere.
Okay, so it was in the city, and so, was it just once, or was it several?
It was just a one night.
It was a one show.
So it was everyone who could come on the night. It was amazing, and that's also on YouTube now. And it's all for up and coming artists. It's something that you can do and experiment and collaborate. And I worked with the makeup artist as well on the day, so she we worked together on how we wanted to style the hair and do the makeup and complement the jewelry. And I made these bird beaks that the girls could wear out of balsa wood and plaster resin. It was just this explosion of collaborating and fun, excitement.
And are you able to track, like, after you've done this catwalk show, did that bring a lot of people traffic to your website, to your Instagram site?
It did bring a little bit to the Instagram, but it was more people trying to sort of contact me directly, I guess, to find out my intentions for the runway, for the way I put it together. It wasn't sort of a typical runway show where you've got your models walking up and down. It was I'm trying to pull jewelry into something that's more fashion as well. So
yep. Yeah. Which will be why Virginia is so interested in yes. your work.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, we probably should describe it. I'm looking, you're wearing quite a few pieces that you've created yes. yourself. And it's, as you mentioned just a second, it's silver, but you've blackened it.
Yeah, I oxidized them just to give them a little bit more depth. A lot of my pieces have meaning. So I've got the barnacles. You know how barnacles will sort of attach themselves to different objects. So that's my idea of strength, and the shark's teeth, that's also empowerment and strength. And
I'm seeing a ring there with a seahorse yes. on it, and another ring with a clam with a pearl inside of it.
Yeah, yeah. So that's just, to be honest, just beautiful things that I love putting together. Some yep. pieces have quite meaningful stories, and some pieces I just
do. You make skull rings?
Love of making. Maybe. Yes,
you
I do. A skull ring.
Oh, we're rather fond of a skull ring, Swanee.
Yeah, maybe Swanee, a sailor's mm-hmm. piece. Yeah.
So the lost wax process, which presumably you're involved in with the silversmithing.
Yeah.
It's a lovely process. There's lots of. Wax is beautiful because you can cut it and you can yes. add to it as well. So it's lovely to carve.
It's quite therapeutic.
Is it?
Yeah, definitely. It's and quite different to the metal process, I think. It's
Well, gold, if you're moving into gold, you'd yeah. be more fabricating, I would have thought, there, isn't there? Less yes, casting
yes
and more
no.
fabricating?
I'm still planning on casting in gold, which is right. going to be quite sort of solid pieces. But anyone who loves my work, I think, would happily take that, you know, commitment into spending a little bit more money into what I'm going to be making.
So a lot of jewelers, I think, find that if they want to work in gold,
yes.
then it's more difficult to do things speculatively because of the cost of the material.
Yes.
And so you really need to have people commissioning things before
yes.
you start.
And I'm lucky to have had that, actually. I found that the last couple of years there's sort of more and more people that are contacting me now that are wanting things that are that have that MG mark to it. Initially I had a lot of people contacting me for pieces that were sort of probably less me. So, yeah.
So actually you mentioned that, and I realized that I haven't, is that your brand name is MG's, EMGEE.
Yeah.
Yes, which is also the website that has now
yes.
just come up.
Yeah.
And that's how people are going to find you, not necessarily as your name, Megan Greenwood.
Yeah.
And I think I read something the other day. Must have been an article in one of the newspapers that said that MG is an alter ego.
Yes, I wanted to create something, another name, another person, so that people weren't necessarily wearing a Megan Greenwood piece. I wanted them to wear this MG piece, which is, I have many stories that I write about different characters. So if I've got a photo shoot, I'll write a beautiful story about that. And I wanted people to be able to put their own personality and their own take on what MG is. Mm-hmm. So they're not necessarily following myself as a person. I wanted to separate that because I feel that myself and my brand, as much as I'm very much one with my brand, we're also very separate.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, and just backstepping a tiny little bit, because John was asking you about the wax process.
Yes.
Which I don't really know anything about. How does that work?
You model something in wax yes. and then you embed it in plaster, furnaceable plaster.
Yes.
And then you melt the wax yeah. out and yes, then fill course. The cavity with whatever metal it is that you want to put in there. I've been making
it's
quite
a great
big,
way to explain it.
I've been making quite big pieces in wax, sculptural lost wax.
Really?
But these days, you know, you can make something out of anything.
Yes.
And have it laser copied and then printed in wax.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's
my
amazing.
Goodness, you could yeah. too, couldn't you?
Mm.
Pretty much anything you want to do, you can do it. I don't think that there should be a, no, you can't do this.
Or your own head, Sally.
Do anything.
I don't want to have a look at my head from different directions, actually, I've got to say, John. So if people wanted to find your work, Megan, yeah. what do they do?
They can look up on my Facebook. I've got the address, and I've also got the address on my Instagram.
Yep.
Well, they can personal message me.
So do they go to MG or do they go to Megan Greenwood?
MG, so mg.com.au.
Yeah, that, yeah, to your website. That's
to
your new
website.
Which
yeah.
we haven't seen yet, but we've only
yes,
just heard that
be.
It's gone live. That's
yeah.
fantastic. Well, it's wonderful. Good luck with it. I'm sure
Thank
we'll
you.
Get Virginia in to talk about the exhibition as
yes.
it comes up
so
soon. Good luck with your work, and I look forward to having a look through your website. Megan Greenwood, thanks for coming on to Arts About today.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Megan.
We've had our next guest, Jock Sarong, on the show before when he was wearing another hat. The lawyer turned author who lives in Port Fairy was the editor of one of my favourite literary publications, The Great Ocean Quarterly. And although there's only six editions, all of them went straight to the pool room at our house, as they were such an outstanding combination of talented artists whose written word and visual imagery were connected to each other by the ocean. These days you can read Jock's feature articles in The Guardian and several surfing magazines, but it's his novels we're interested in today. Jock has written three books, and his third one, On the Java Ridge, has taken him around the country just lately and soon brings him to the Mornington Peninsula to talk to us. These three novels have been very enthusiastically received, and the first, Quota, won the 2015 Ned Kelly Award for the Best Crime Novel in 2016, and The Rules of Backyard Cricket, his second novel, was shortlisted for the Victoria Premier's Literary Award and made the bestseller lists. His new novel is called On the Java Ridge, and I'm going to be talking to him about it at the literary lunch at Cakes and Ale in association with Antipodes Bookshop in Sorrento on Friday the 25th. Good morning, Jock Sarong, and welcome to Arts About once again.
G'day, Sally. How are you?
Good, thank you. Did I get all that right?
You did.
You did well. That's great. Listen, you've come off the back of an incredibly busy tour. I've heard you've spoken at the Williamstown Literary Festival. You've been at Farrell's Bookshop in Mornington a couple of weeks ago, the Byron Bay Writers Festival, and there's probably quite a few others.
Yeah, I just got back from Mudgee last night, actually.
Oh, did you? I'll bet you did a bit of surfing up there, too. In those parts.
Yeah.
Where is Mudgee? I'm thinking of Mudgeribah.
Mudgee's inland, New South Wales. Ah. It's a long way from the surf.
So. Oh, okay, sorry. Sorry for my very lousy geographical knowledge.
I would have tried to surf if I could.
Jock, you and I are going to meet in the flesh and have a conversation about your new book On the Java Ridge at the literary lunch at Cakes and Ale coming up. Is this what a writer's life is like these days? Most of us imagine that it's kind of a private thing, but is the public thing a necessity that you're compelled to do, or is it actually fun?
Yeah, oh, well, both of those things. Mm-hmm. I think I imagined when I started out that you kind of emerge from your lair just for long enough to hand over the manuscript and then sort of return to it for another period of deep dormancy, but you do actually have to get out and tour the book, I suppose, you know, for want of a better expression. And it's great because it's an antidote to that really solitary way of working. And also, it's just lovely to have the feedback and the discussion around the book as much as it is to write it.
Mm, I'll bet it is. I mean, perhaps does it feed into maybe the next thing?
Yeah, and what always amazes me is that the minute you let go of a book and it becomes a public thing, you're nothing more than a participant in a conversation from then on. And people have their own ideas about what the characters are up to and what's really ticking in the depths of the book. And it's fascinating that opinion about the book is really no more or less valid than mine, even though I wrote it.
Mm. Now, I've just started your new book On the Java Ridge, so only just begun it, and we're going to be talking about that next week. But without giving too much away or too much that you wouldn't actually get from reading the back cover blurb, it's a political thriller set on a boat called the Java Ridge that hosts safaris in Indonesia, while a federal election looms in Australia and a hardline new government policy is announced regarding maritime assistance to asylum seekers in distress. And you place your protagonists, your fun-loving surfing tourists, in the path of one of these catastrophes. They're the first responders to a wrecking of a boat filled with refugees. It's hard to imagine you're not angry about our current laws, are you?
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair comment. But that said, it was very important to me in writing the book that first and foremost I wanted to write a story. And, you know, any good fiction is about placing your characters in some form of peril or conflict and then seeing how they work their way through it. The commentary about asylum seeker policy is certainly there, but I've tried to use those characters as a bit of a lens to study it rather than to go on a rant about it.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, the way that those Australians are dealt with and the way that they deal with the predicament allows people to make their own judgments about asylum seeker policy.
Oh, yes, okay. Your first book, Quota, also combines your obvious love of the sea with a couple of other passions that I think perhaps might be in this new book, the law, and also where is that defining moral compass?
Yeah, Quota is very much about a search for a moral compass. And again, I guess it was an attempt to, first novels tend to be autobiographical, and Quota's probably no exception, but it's about throwing people out of their element. So in Quota, you have a guy from the city who's thrown into a country town environment, and then the reverse, the country kid goes to the city. In Java Ridge, you've got surfers who are in the middle of something very hedonistic, just having a great holiday, when they're confronted with the need to deal with a rescue situation. I guess there is that commonality in making people feel extremely uncomfortable and then seeing how those characters deal with it.
Mm. Interestingly, your second novel, which I loved, by the way, I read it over summer, The Rules of Backyard Cricket, I have to confess I know nothing about cricket at all, although I do probably know a little bit more now. But that doesn't have anything much to do with the sea, but it has that overarching moral question around two brothers who sidestep there or bring into play this question of morality, who's wearing the white hat, who's wearing the black hat, and that is it's a terrific book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you're right that the premise in Backyard Cricket is very, very different. I had this idea for Darren Keith as a character just sort of burning in me that I could see him, I could hear him, and I knew his mannerisms from the word go. And I don't think that happens all the time. I think that's a bit of an exception as a writer, that you have this character demanding to be heard in your head. So writing him through his life story was not a difficult exercise. The difficult bits were the other people, like his brother Wally, who I found very hard to picture. And I think it turns out that the reason for that is that Wally was kind of an unknowable man. In a sense, he's the hollow man.
Yes, well, his where he ended up was completely shocking.
Yes. Yeah. The less we know about our public figures, the better.
Quite. And I have to say, I kept, as I was reading that book, it was so visual to me too. Your style is very visual. I could see those characters. In fact, they have faces for me, both of those brothers. I shouldn't be going on about that book. Your fabulous new book is the one that we'll be talking about, and particularly talking about at the event on the 25th down at Cakes and Ale, who are is the restaurant down in Sorrento that has been hosting a series of literary lunches along with Antipodes, the bookshop next door. Clearly, you write for many publications, Jock. You're also writing for The Guardian, Surfing World, and Australian Surf Business. No medals for guessing that surfing is another one of those passions of yours.
Yeah, it is. It is, and it fits well with writing, I guess. I spend long, long periods slumped at a desk, like a lot of people do with their lives, and surfing's the way I kind of unfurl myself at some stage during the day. But it's a really interesting subject for writing. I find it a lot easier to write about as non-fiction, to write interviews and profiles and write about the issues than as fiction. I think it's a really tough thing to write fiction around because it's a singular experience, and the temptation to cliche and the temptation to stereotyping is so enormous. And I wonder if that's why a lot of writers don't attempt it.
Yeah, I wonder too. I would imagine that we have a huge percentage of people down here on the Mornington Peninsula who have chosen to live down here because of their shared love of the sea and the waves and that surfing culture. And you're right, it is very hard to think of any in either in literary terms or on the screen that hasn't been stereotyped. And when
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think the two reference points that people tend to go to are Breast by Tim Winton, and more recently William Finnegan's Barbarian Days.
Oh, I don't know that.
That's a memoir. Finnegan's a New Yorker writer, and he was a war correspondent at one stage. memoir of his life as a surfer, but the writing's so incredibly good that it won the Pulitzer.
Ah, okay. Well, there you are. I didn't know. On the Java Ridge, it's... when did you finish writing that, Jock?
I reckon the last edits went in about March.
So it's very, very new. It's really just out there.
Yeah, released 2 weeks ago.
Well, I'm really looking forward to cramming it in over the next week before we get to speak to each other. Jock Sarong is going to be appearing in conversation with me at Cakes and Ale on Friday the 25th of August. That's in Ocean Beach Road in Sorrento to talk about this wonderful new book. And you can enjoy a beautiful three-course lunch and hear Jock in conversation. Thanks so much for talking to us today, Jock. It's been a great pleasure and I look forward to talking to you at further length next week.
Thanks very much, Sally. Cheers.
Talk to you soon. Bye. The Police Point Shire Park is a nationally significant cultural heritage site located in the lands of the Boon Wurrung Balug, one of the six clans of the Boon Wurrung people who are part of the Kulin Nation in central Victoria. From the 1850s to the 1870s, it was the location of the local police barracks and the quarantine station, and the gatekeeper's cottage there was occupied by police officers and the first quarantine station superintendent. In 1970, the site was used by the Department of Defence, and most recently in 2004, the government transferred the land and the historic cottages to the Mornington Peninsula Shire, and the park was established. We here at Arts About have been agitating for some time that the Gatekeeper's Cottage should be used as an artist-in-residency program, and finally it seems that this is happening. These days, the Police Point Shire Park Artist-in-Residence programs open to all emerging and established artists, writers, musicians and creatives, and the Shire invites expressions of interest for both supported and fee-paying residencies. Our next guest is artist Siobhan Kelly, and she's the latest artist to have been included in the program down there. And we've got her on the line here to hear how it's going, what it's like there, and what she might be doing with the fabulous paintings I've seen of the park from that sensational viewpoint. Good morning, Siobhan.
Good morning, Sally.
Thanks so much for talking to us here on Arts About.
Thank you for having me.
Siobhan, how far into your residency are you now?
I finish up on Friday, so I've been here for 2 weeks.
And what was the basis of your residency? Did you apply to do anything in particular down there? How did you get to be an artist working down there for a couple of weeks?
My proposal was to come down here and paint the light, particularly. So I paint landscape and I predominantly paint plein air, so out in the landscape. And I have found, I actually live in Tookaroook, so not that far away, but I've found the light down here to be quite different from anywhere else around the bay. And my thought process tells me that it's such a narrow strip of land between two quite big bodies of water that there's a lot of reflected light. And even looking out over towards Queenscliff, the light, sort of reflected light from the other side, it's very different to anywhere else that I've noticed. So that was my main proposal, to come down and paint light and to paint sort of from the same location on various days and various conditions, just to see how that light changed over time. I've been painting sunrises and sunsets, which has been interesting too, because it's so variable. I came down here this morning, down to quarantine. I did a painting, and you could actually see the rain over on the other side of the bay, passing up towards Melbourne. We didn't get any here, but it was quite cloudy, and the sun was hiding behind the clouds. It was magnificent light, and now clear blue skies. So it varies, and it is very quick, the change in the conditions. So I think being exposed to that, it's different from being in the studio or even being out for an hour or two. When you're constantly exposed to it, you notice the changes a lot more.
How do you get them onto the canvas that quickly then? It must actually be speeding you up.
It does, especially sunrise and sunsets, because it happens quite quickly. I find in the middle part of the day, things tend to slow down a little, and especially days like today when it has cleared, the transition of the sun is not as predominant as when it's coming down and going, coming up in the mornings. But it does make you quite quick and frenetic, maybe. And I've become quite messy. So not only is the paint applied to the canvas in a much more frenetic sort of way, but I have paint tubes flying everywhere. I've lost a few paint lids because I just pull them off and throw them away and try to get the paint out as quickly as possible onto a pallet or just directly onto the canvas.
Well done, so, Siobhan. Yeah. I like the sound of that. I like the sound of the half-squeezed tubes everywhere and the lids missing. It sounds like a studio to me. And I think you're absolutely right about the light down there, about the amount of water that there is around you and the light reflecting off it. And I had a look at a few of your paintings. I've noticed that you're clearly learning how to handle moving water as well, which is quite a difficult thing to paint generally.
It is, and I've had some quite windy days, and from the north, so blowing straight into where the cottage is, it comes straight off the bay, straight into you, and the northwesterlies, and they've been up to sort of 50 to 60 kilometre winds.
Yeah.
And so that obviously agitates the water, and not only that, I think being out there in those conditions, all you want to do is get back. So it makes you work quite quickly. And
have they got the cottage set up in a quite cosy way? Is it nice in there?
It's got a great heater in here.
Right. And last time I was there, they were talking about building an added studio to the cottage. Have they built that?
No. There's a very nice, comfortable studio here with great north light. Right. And even the sun coming through that warms the place up quite nicely.
It's such a fantastic venue. The location is just mind-blowing, frankly. You know, it's very unusual. The cottage out there by itself on a rolling lawn facing north across the bay. It's absolutely fantastic.
And fabulous to be seeing some work, taking that landscape in, actually seeing it on canvas. I haven't seen a great deal of those images.
No, it's sometimes a bit overwhelming trying to decide where to actually set up and paint. And even this morning, I looked at the whole bay and I thought, oh my gosh, I could paint that bit there or that bit there or that bit there. So making decisions about what you paint is, you sort of need to take a bit of time in deciding.
Because, I'd be inclined to have a cup of tea and lay around reading a book, I think.
Which would mean you'd probably have to be there for an awful lot longer. Are you there by yourself?
I am, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it, what's it like at night down there, being so remote?
Oh, it's not too bad because there's actually a few portsy houses, holiday houses, that you can see through the kitchen window. Yeah. So you don't feel too isolated. But my family's been coming and staying with me on the weekends, and we walked into quarantine on Saturday night. And it's a little bit freaky because there's so many abandoned buildings. Like, they're not occupied, and especially at night. Mm. There's people down there during the day, and there's offices down there. But a lot of those buildings just are empty. And there's such a sense of history there that particular area of quarantine has a real sense of spirit of the place. And you get that. You sort of, you get tingles when you're down there. It's an overwhelming sense of history and, not just the military and the actual quarantine station, but going right back to, as you said in your introduction, to, the local people. So, there's a lot there.
Mm. Are you going to put together an exhibition of the work you've been making down there, do you think?
Oh, I hope so. I haven't got anything planned yet. Once I've put together all this work, I'm actually looking forward to taking it out of this place and taking it back to my studio and looking at it again, because I think I'll see it differently once it's removed from here. Because some of the work I'm making, some of it I'm quite happy with, and some of it I feel like it's just failed dismally. But I think removing it from the actual place helps give you a different perspective, and I'm looking forward to that aspect of it. But having the work, I've now got images I can approach galleries with, so it would be great to put something together. Mm. And I would like to do perhaps some larger works, because the works I'm doing are quite small. I think about 40 by 40 is the largest, so not big.
Mm.
But I feel like they need to be small to get that energy in them. But I am looking forward to trying something on a larger scale and experimenting, just seeing if that same energy comes through. It has changed the way that I paint and approach the canvas, and even as I was saying that, you know, throwing of tubes down onto the ground and lost lids, and you know, just that sort of, it's a different energy to the previous way that I've painted.
You have to be careful, Siobhan, of standing on tubes, because it's expensive and messy.
Absolutely. Hey, it's been great talking to you today. Please keep us informed and let us know if you do put together this, if it comes together in an exhibition. We'd love to direct some of our listeners to go and have a look.
I would appreciate that. Thank you, Sally.
So great talking to you today, Siobhan Kelly. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. And now it's time for John On.
Here we are, you know, left till last.
Yes, how do you feel about being left till last today?
I'm all right.
Yeah, good. Greece.
Greece. About 40 years ago. 40 years ago.
Oh, four score.
Yeah. The brother and I were in Athens.
Is this the Drew or Steve?
Drew.
Drew, yes.
And we thought we'd take a trip out to the Greek islands. And we went down to Piraeus and got on the ferry and headed off. And there was hardly anyone on the ferry, which was kind of nice and encouraging. We met some Americans on the ferry, and they said to us, well, it's early in the summer, so not a lot of people are going out to the islands yet. They'll come out later on. So it's a good time to be going out there, they said. You'll be able to find where you want to be and settle yourself in for the summer, which was what we planned to do. We got to the island of our choice, and there was hardly anyone there except the Greeks. And, you know, at the time, 40 years ago, this island, the internal combustion engine hadn't really been embraced. Everything went from the port up to the village on donkeys.
Yeah, wow.
And the boats had diesel engines in them, but they were little dock diesels.
Yep.
So it was quite a nice sound. And there was one old bus that ran from the village down to the beach on the other side of the island and back, and just kept going all day.
Basically everything was on foot.
And you walked everywhere.
Mm.
And there were these ravines that rang from the village down to the coastline. You could pick a ravine and scramble down, get to the bottom, and there'd be no one there, and just this crystal clear water running off the rocks into the ocean floor. A beautiful place. The weather was perfect. But we found a an apartment or a flat or somewhere to stay, which was right on the very top of the hill, on the top of the village. And the back wall of it was the back wall of the local church, which had that sort of white round dome on it and the bell on top.
Oh, yeah. It's the quintessential Greek church.
Yeah, the guys with the big tall hats and the beards hanging around.
With the aquamarine water behind it.
Yeah, yeah. It was all of that. Yeah. It was absolutely mind-blowing. The drachma was pretty weak at the time, and we were paying $1 a day. $7 a week it was for this place.
It's incredible, isn't it?
And we could look down over the whole island and the village and all the beaches and down into the port from the front little deck area that it had on it, the patio. And we just started to embrace the village and enjoy it. But I walked around the corner from where we were and met the Americans again, and we were talking to them, and they said, you're interested in art, aren't you? And I said, I am. And they said, there's an American artist who lives on the island, and he's over there. And they pointed off in some direction. And I wandered along this path, a donkey path, to a little shack. And there, sure enough, there was this fellow in there. And he was making, he was buying newspapers off the ferry, Greek, like Athens newspapers, broadsheets, and spreading out the broadsheet and decorating them with blues and little white squares, as you would, and then with melted beeswax, covering them in wax and letting the wax dry, and it was kind of discoloured and very shiny and quite crisp, you know, and then he'd screw them up and flatten them out again. And they had a kind of an aged look about them, and it was very unclear what they might be paintings of, except that when you looked out the window, that's what was out there, all this blue and white and square shapes, you know. And so it was obvious when you were there, you know.
Yes,
you
okay, were, so it's site-specific work.
Yeah, if you were looking at them in that room, you knew exactly what that was about. But it did occur to me that if you saw these things elsewhere, sitting on the on a bench somewhere or something, it would,
in another country,
it would be litter.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's interesting that the point being, I suppose, that art is sometimes has a very has a location driven purpose or importance, and sometimes it's difficult to imagine specific works of art being art at all when they're in the wrong place. And others travel quite well. We're all used to seeing Renaissance paintings travelling. I mean, they were made to sit in churches in in Europe, and but we see them in big white rooms in galleries in Australia, and they don't seem out of place. I mean, what you're doing is looking at the work of art, and it's not missing its home location necessarily. You can still dig it.
Yeah, that's right.
But other art won't survive the journey, and it was interesting that I was looking at this stuff and thinking that won't survive the distance anywhere. There are other people on the island who are making watercolours, which were sort of memorials of their trip to the island, and they'd be able to take them back to their house, put them on the wall and look at them and be reminded of being, you know, it was a picture of the island, you know, rather than a picture of the experience.
Yeah, the and so do you think that that means in a way that abstract art fares more difficult?
I think American abstract expressionist paintings travel very well, oddly. You know, they don't have to be in New York in order to have that whole ringing of New York coming out of them. They have got, they've got a fair bit of clout on their own. And obviously the paintings that don't travel well and don't translate from one place to another are ones that we're not familiar with because we don't see them.
Yeah, very profound, John. That's good. That's interesting. I'm listening. I'm hearing it's time for the news.
I can hear that going on in the background.
Yeah. End of the show. It's come upon us very, very quickly. Just to recap, Jock Sarong's going to be in conversation at Cakes and Ale on Friday the 25th of August.
Yeah, with you.
With me. I'm going to be doing guiding that conversation. Yeah, so that will be a bit fun.
Do that.
Oh, that'd be good. The Melbourne Spring Fashion Festival is coming soon, and we'll remind you as time gets closer to have a look at the fabulous exhibition in the Town Hall, which in which you'll get to see Megan Greenwood's work, MG. I'll put a link to her work up on the Facebook page.
She said she was from Wagga.
Yeah, I know.
It's Wagga Wagga.
It is Wagga Wagga. I don't think people from Wagga are allowed to say just Wagga, are they?
I don't know.
No, I don't think they are. Well, the House of Dior exhibition's opening at NGV.
I'm going to that.
Are you? Yes, of course. The House of Dior, 70 Years of Haute Couture, opens on the 27th.
I'm a Balenciaga fan, but I'll go and have a look at Dior.
Yeah. It seems like fashion's become a bit of a blockbuster these days. And so I've just read an article that the Dr. Gary Willis wrote that's been published in a couple of magazines on that very subject. It's titled How Art Became Fashion's Poor Cousin. So I think I'll put a link on our Facebook page to that, but I think we might get Gary in next week.
I would
week
phrase
or the week
it differently.
After.
I would say, has art become fashion's poor cousin, you know? Mm. But Gary knows what he's talking about generally.
Yeah, he does.
The man who burnt my house down.
What?
Well, he's made a painting of your front yard, which has got a view of our house, and our house is in flames.
It's true. I've forgotten that. Yes, indeed. Have you heard about the pop-up Globe Theatre coming to Melbourne very soon?
I saw an article on that somewhere.
Yeah. Yes. Apparently, the pop-up Globe has literally popped out of nowhere in the Shakespeare Gardens next to Melbourne's Sydney Meyer Music Bowl. Mm. The project was originally planned as a one-off in Auckland to celebrate the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, and it has become an enormous hit. They sold out and restaged it and sold out for the second time, so it's coming to Melbourne by popular demand. Here on the 21st of September through to the 12th of November.
They're going to burn it down?
No, I shouldn't think so. I suspect it's made of scaffolding. But they've got five different Shakespeare plays on there over that period. So that sounds pretty exciting. If you've just tuned in, you've missed Arts About. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from you. We'd like to know what you think about the show, what you'd like to hear, and if you visit our Facebook page, you'll find some links to some of the things we've been talking about on the show. Like us and become part of our online community and have a bit of an input into the discussion. You'll find a link to our Facebook page on the RPP website. Join us again 11 a.m. next Sunday, or hear the repeat on Wednesdays at 12, or listen to the podcasts on the station website. And remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art,
but we'd know what we'd think if we'd only get a look at it.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Brody.
Thank you, Brody.